Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. This is part two of our interview with Andre Dubuse III. Andre is joining us this morning from Massachusetts, and I am very delighted to have him as our premier guest. And today we're going to discuss the work of Andre's father, also named Andre Dubuse. And if you have not read Andre Dubuse, then by the end of this interview, I hope that you will go out to your bookstore and discover the world of Andre Dubuse, because in my opinion, he is one of the finest writers of our generation. So Andre, welcome back to the show. We're delighted to have you again. And I'd like to tell everyone that this is the first time that you and I have actually talked.
Yeah.
And I had a correspondence with your father that began in 1985 and ended in 1999 when he died. And tell me a bit, if you would, about the... let's talk a minute about a book of tributes that was done.
Mm.
And you and I are not going to make a penny off this, okay? So if anyone thinks that we're shamelessly promoting this book, that is not the case. Neither one of us would earn a penny if we would sell all the copies. But there is a book called Andre Dubuse Tributes, which was edited by Donald Anderson, that you wrote a foreword to, and Tobias Wolff wrote an afterword to. And it's published by Xavier Review Press, and it is available online. And there's nothing more I would like than to help Xavier Review Press sell out those copies so that we can get another edition of that book out. So if we can accomplish that in this hour, then I think your father would smile down on us, not for the recognition, but just that we're putting the effort into it.
Well, you're right. He wouldn't do it for recognition because he was always very humble.
Yeah, yeah. Your father began his life as a novelist, and in the foreword to the book Andre Dubuse Tributes, you talk about when the novel that he did write, The Lieutenant, was optioned as a film starring Burt Lancaster. And as a child, as a young man, you were kind of unaware of what writers did and this kind of thing. And your dad goes off, or your pops, as you call him, goes off to Hollywood and comes back. And do you remember that time vividly?
Well, I do, but I should really ground it more of a context for any listeners. We were just broke-ass poor, man. I mean, my mom was a housewife at home, which was the mid-60s. And my dad was a college professor making $7,000 a year.
Wow.
Seven. Full-time teacher. Four kids. We lived out in a rented... It was actually, I know now, as an older person now, I know that it was an uninsulated 2x4 framed summer cottage we lived in year-round. And so when Hollywood called one day in the form of Burt Lancaster, my mom jumping up and down, you know, holding the phone to her breast because she's such a handsome idol.
Right.
The energy that I got from it was, this could change our lives. We might actually get some money and live better.
I can relate.
I didn't think about writing or movies. I thought about, really? We can get a car that'll start, Mom? It was really one of those moments.
Yeah.
And but nothing came of it. The truth is, my father hated working on the screenplay. And it was right about that time in his life that he was reading for the first time quite deeply his lifelong writing mentor, Anton Chekhov.
Mm-hmm.
And he started writing short stories, and he tossed the novel he'd been working on, and he just let the screen project fall away, and he started to write what would become his master form, the short story.
Mm-hmm. And I we mentioned Phil Spitzer's name earlier. And to the audience, that is the agent for both Andre Dubuse III and his father, Andre Dubuse.
Ainsley Burke, our cousin, and his daughter, Alice Fair. He's like the family agent.
Yeah. So please don't deluge Phil with a bunch of manuscripts. he's got more than he can handle already. So our
family.
Yeah, just your family. So and Michael Conley. So it's like,
right.
he doesn't need unsolicited manuscripts. And Phil, if you're listening, we're not trying to kill you. So Phil Spitzer believed in your father's work And I believe he describes in the Book of Tributes that it was almost like taking a vow of poverty. That he understood he was never going to become rich off of your father's work. And that there was one story that you discussed that was about 100 pages long, and your father says to you, "I found the seven pages."
Yeah.
And I think that probably Phil at that point in time said, "Okay, I'm not going to try to get this guy to expand his work. I'll just take the pages I can get."
Yeah.
I don't know any other writer that I've ever heard that about.
I've met very few. I don't know if I ever have either. You know, Dad was in it for the long haul, meaning he was trying to write literature. And, you know, we throw that word around.
Yeah.
But it's a real high word. It's up there with the divinities in my mind. And, you know, I think a very good writer can work 30 years and he or she may achieve literature two or three times.
I agree.
You know, he achieved it with all his work. But it's because he did things like that. He would have 100, I believe the story you're talking about, I think it was way over 100, close to 140 pages, which is close to a short novel and something more marketable,
mm-hmm.
you know, out there. And but the truth is that creature he was creating had to be seven pages.
Yeah.
So he was listening to its nature. We talked about it earlier. We talked about, you know, the parental thing.
Yeah. Do you remember what he said to you when you asked him about that, about where the seven pages came from?
Yeah.
If you would, tell the listeners what your father said.
He said they came from over 100 pages, and I cut them down to seven. And I remember I was in college at the time, and I hadn't started writing fiction myself. I had no idea what he was talking about. And what do you mean? How could you have cut so much? He said, "It was just stuff I needed to know, but wasn't part of the story. Didn't need to be there. And this was really intriguing me." He said the story wanted to be seven pages.
Yeah.
The story wanted to be.
Right. Right.
But okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And it was kind of funny because I discovered your father's work in 1984, and I remember I was in a bookstore in Bexley, Ohio, and I saw this book sitting on the shelf, and it was a picture of your father, and the title was "The Times Are Never So Bad," and I opened the book up and I saw the epigraph was from Sir Thomas More: "The times are never so bad, but that a good man can live in them."
Right.
And I had recently gone through a lot of changes in my life, and I thought, wow. And then on the back, I read some of the reviews, and I bought the book. I took it home, and I read it. And I was absolutely blown away with the structure and the prose, but the feelings and the emotions that your father brought out in me. And then later that same year, I saw Voices from the Moon, and I ran over and grabbed it and took it home and read it. And I tell people who, when we discuss your father's work, I say, read Voices from the Moon and then tell me what you think about it. And I've yet to have a person come back and tell me that it wasn't one of the finest pieces of writing they've ever read. And they kind of insisted on publishing that as a novel, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Actually, Godin did publish it as a novel. I forget what year, back in the 80s, and I remember it's one of these publishing decisions. It's a beautiful novella.
Exactly.
Which he also excelled in that form. You know, the short story, I believe he published over 90 of them in his life, which is an amazing amount. You know, I think your reader should know his most. He was in a real productive time all through his 40s, I would say that whole decade. And he did 3 to 4 stories every year.
Exactly.
Which is a phenomenal amount of work.
That is.
And what was I going to say, though? You're talking about Voices in the Moon. But he also excelled at the novella, which, you know, this 70 to 120 page form, which is beautiful. I love that shape.
I know, but it's a dirty word, isn't it?
It is in publishing, but, you know, screw publishing.
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, since we're talking about that, let's talk about We Don't Live Here Anymore, which let's inform the readers who perhaps haven't had the gift of reading the novellas yet. Your father wrote 4 novellas, which were collected in a book that was titled We Don't Live Here Anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it is outside of The Pretty Girl, which was not in the same Hank and Edith series. The 3 novellas that do involve recurring characters there's a new edition which is going to be coming out in tandem with the release of the film We Don't Live Here Anymore. Mm-hmm. And I remember sending you a note when the screenplay won the best screenplay at the Sundance Film Festival, and I said, Andre, I didn't know that they were doing We Don't Live Here Anymore. And tell me how you found out about it.
We didn't either. I had no idea. I was actually excuse me, I was at a swanky party in Los Angeles in the belly of the beast, my own movie out, and this man came up whom I knew years ago. He was actually he's the son of Bill Goodman. His name's Jonas Goodman. Bill Goodman was my father's mentor editor at
right.
Godin Publishing for years. My
yeah.
father was very fond of him. He was really a father figure to my dad. Jonas Goodman, it turns out, has been a movie producer all these years, and he says, hey, we're really excited about the movie. I said, oh, thanks, I'm glad you like it. He said, no, your dad's movie. I said, what, which one, In the Bedroom? He said, no, the new one. And I was a little concerned because my sister and I are co-executors of the estate. We hadn't heard anything.
You're kidding.
No, but it's not a big deal. It's all up above board. What happened
yeah.
was that my dad had sold the rights to Columbia almost 30 years ago.
That's unbelievable.
And they finally got it made. That's how long these things take.
And so it kept getting optioned and optioned?
Yeah. No, it did for a while, and then I think the rights were sold to Columbia outright.
Okay.
And then it just sat on their shelf for a couple, 20 years.
Wow.
So, we're really excited to see it. I hear it's a really good film. And but I'm more excited about the fact that, once again, there's an opportunity for people to discover my father's great work. Because here's the sad truth. Not enough people have read him.
No.
You know, not enough people have read this man, and his audience is growing, but, man, I'd like to see it growing more and more.
Yeah.
And I have faith it will.
Yeah, and as you know, I've been on a, not a one-man crusade, but I've been on a crusade.
Yeah, you have.
Yeah.
And we're grateful.
Yeah, I've been, I try to spread the word of your father's work wherever I go,
mm-hmm.
and because it deserves it.
Yeah, man. Well, it's art, and very, very little of what you're going to read is art.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah. Let's take a break here for a moment. You're listening to the Casey Kowar Show, A Celebration of the Word. We're talking with Andre Dubuse III today about the work of his father, the writer Andre Dubuse. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Casey Kowar Show. Our guest today is Andre Dubuse III. We're discussing the work of his father, Andre Dubuse. And a lot of times, Andre, people say to me, well, I've read a story I saw in The Bedroom, which was based on a short story that your father did called Killings, which was written in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell me, what should I read that Andre wrote? And I kind of guide them towards the selected stories because...
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful collection of his work, which does include the novel/novella, We Don't Live Here Anymore. And I think that is a wonderful place for a reader to discover your father's work.
Yes, I'm sorry, my oldest son just got home. Which story did you just say?
I was talking about just the collected works.
The collected stories. Yeah, I agree, because what you get there is a sample of about 25 years of work. You get some very early stuff, and you get some later stuff, and you get the longer ones and the shorter ones. And you know what, I just had the wonderful experience of rereading those three novellas, We Don't Live Here Anymore, Adultery, and Finding a Girl in America.
Same here.
Yeah, I reread those because I've just written the introduction for the tie-in edition for the movie coming out. And what was so nice is, you know, Dad's been gone 5.5 years, and I sometimes forget how present he was in all of his work,
mm-hmm.
which is not... Not a value. I mean, it just is. Hemingway was very present in his work. Faulkner was present in his work. My father is present in his work. There are some wonderful writers who disappear. You don't know where they are, and their work is just as strong. So I'm not saying that as a value judgment.
No.
What I'm saying is I love spending time with the old man again.
Yes. Yes.
It was just beautiful. And I closed that last page of Finding a Girl in America and opened a beer and sat on the porch where my dad and I sat for years and would sneak cigars when my kids weren't looking and talk about whatever. And
yeah.
I raised a glass to the stars. And
yep. Yep, I've had the feeling at times that that he's still around. And if this is going to be a gift we'll give the listeners, read a father's story.
Yeah.
And if you read that story, and if you don't put the book down several times with the power of some of the sentences in the final passage where the narrator's talking to God, and if you don't pick the book up and read the next story, shame on you.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the finest stories. That I think is one of the finest stories in literature, along with Dancing After Hours, the story. I think there are two examples of classic short stories.
Well, you know, his last book, Dancing After Hours, every single one of those stories, the short, the long, especially some of my favorites in there, they're very short ones. The Last Moon, Love Song, there were 2, 3, 4 pages long. They are like poems, and I really feel as if he was writing at the absolute peak of his powers, that almost a part of him knew that he wasn't going to be here much longer.
Yes.
And let me give you an image, Casey, that I think about a lot, I see in my head often. You know, he had had a mild heart attack. You know, he died of heart failure 5 years ago, but he had had a mild heart attack. And by the way, I don't think any of that would have crept up on him if he hadn't been sitting in a wheelchair for 13 years.
Yes. Because he was a very active man.
Very active, virile guy. Even in a wheelchair, I mean, yeah. He worked out and shadow box, and he would do this thing where he would shadow box and sing to Sinatra. Because he
learned
in
the
Marines that, you know, he got winded by doing that, sounding off that cadence while marching. He said, well, man, if I could sing while I'm shadow boxing, I'd get more of a cardio.
Do you have any videos of that?
No. We might, actually.
God, that would...
It might be in some old home video. And he sang terribly off-key. He was no crooner.
Well, maybe you don't want to hear him then.
No, but it's just so sweet because you got to work out. Anyway.
Yeah.
I was coming back from a long day carpentry, and I'd heard that Dad had a mild heart attack. So I went to the hospital pretty terrified, even though they said mild. You know, you always worry about that.
Sure.
And I walked into his room at the hospital, I think it was in Boston, and the bed was empty, so I was even more terrified. And I went, you know, I was walking down the hall trying to find someone, trying to find him, and then I see the wheels of his wheelchair kind of sticking out into the hallway, and I look over his shoulder. He's sitting in a chair, and it's a little bathroom in there, and he's using the sink as a desk, and he's writing, and he's in a Johnny. I kind of tapped him on the shoulder. He looked healthy as hell. I said, hey, what are you doing? He said, oh, hey, man, I couldn't write in there. All these people are coming in, phones ringing, and nurses. I'm just going to get some words. I said, oh, okay, I'll see you later. I packed away, and I stood there in the hall. just looked at his head and the wheels and him writing away on the sink and thought, God bless him.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the reason that Andre's pop was in a wheelchair was a tragic accident that took place in 1986, I believe, wasn't it, Andre?
Yeah, July 23rd, 86.
Okay. My father died July 21st, 1976.
Wow.
Yeah. We don't have to go into the details of the accident. If you want to find out about recovering from grief, read Broken Vessels and Meditations from a Movable Chair. And I've given that book so often to people that are going through grief and loss, and the courage that it took to write some of the essays that are in Meditations from a Movable Chair and Broken Vessels are just very heartwarming. They're very spiritual and very soothing.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about his form being the short story and the novella, but, you know, it was also the essay, wasn't it?
Yes. I'll never forget, Andre, the day the New Yorker came and there was an article in there called Why I Gave Up My Gun.
Yeah.
And I don't have it here in front of me, but the last paragraph of that essay, and I'm not even going to try to, I think I know it by heart, but I'm not going to say it because I might miss a word or two and I wouldn't dishonor your father in that way, but it's about his decision to trust and sit in a wheelchair in God's hands.
And to face his fears. Let's just quote the very last half of the line. The last few words I do know are, yeah. From now on, I will sit in the, right now is where his quote begins, the frighteningly invisible palm of God.
Exactly. Exactly. I read that. I put the magazine down, and I couldn't even move for about, I think it was like 10 minutes. And
now, I'll tell you what does that. You know, we both know what does that. Truth.
Yes.
Truth. I mean, I think this is what makes it art. This is why his work is literature, and this is why it's going to last a long, long time. I don't know if there are universal truths. I think there probably are, but I think the job of the fiction writer is to find the specific and to find them through each individual writer. And his truths were bathed in devout Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
He was shaped by his time. He grew up in Louisiana in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. He was very much a man of that generation, but he also wasn't. He's from the South. This whole thing about Southern writers being ahead of the pack, I think, is true
mm-hmm.
in terms of language.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that's there. And you know, when you mention the essays, which I loved, you know, the way I read my father's work is every time he finished a piece, be it an essay or a short story or a novella, he would copy off six or seven copies, you know, Xerox copies, and he just inscribed them to us and give them to us.
That's beautiful.
So I've read all his books in manuscript, and honestly, I realized just a few years ago there are some books I've never actually picked up and read because I read them in manuscript and forgot that I actually hadn't cracked the book.
Yeah, that's great. And I would mention in the book by Xavier Review Press, Andre Dubuque's Tributes, that there are pictures of your father's manuscript in the book, and it's a real treat to be able to see his writing and in longhand, and
yeah.
That I thought Donald was brilliant when he did that.
Yeah, it's a very classy book.
Yeah, I know my wife Tina, when she read the piece that he did, Single White Male, in the
yeah.
Tributes. And should I read that?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's read that, because we've got time, and that's one of the beauty.
It says so much about
yeah.
who he was.
Okay, everybody, you're in for a treat. And I would like to have Andre read it, but I'm going to read it because I've got it in my hand. And this is, like I say, it's from the Book of Tributes by Xavier Review Press. This is from a letter to a friend on July 6th, 1988. Pills aren't working. Adrenaline from the workshop, from the work I'm trying to do on the long essay in this hiatus of joy. Probably ephemeral, but ain't they all? So I lay in bed amusing myself and came up with this. Quote, SWM 52, good physical condition except for amputated left leg and crippled right one. Largely confined to wheelchair, fiction writer, divorced father of six, who despises money, is presently living on credit. Seeks companionship of female with or without children, who loves the sea, beaches, woods, sky, weather, drinking in bars, jazz, and country and opera, lying idly in the sun, reading fiction and poetry, a spurner of psychobabble and psychotherapy, who strives for a spiritual life while remaining hedonistic, must be witty and kind, good to my six-year-old and 18-month-old daughters, resilient and passionate, must not love money and things, but must enjoy smoking and other such pleasures of the flesh, like daylight and nocturnal lovemaking and pleasurable distractions, like movies and idle talk, and must have a car till I can buy one. Honesty absolutely required, and spontaneous, justified, and even loud and obscene anger are not essential, but would season the relationship. This is not all fun in the sun, but a durable, graceful dance to the music of mortality. Former nuns of light heart are welcome. Unquote. I mean, that says it all, doesn't it?
That completely captures the old man and his love of this world. You know, when we eulogized him, I forget all I said, but I know I began with a quote, which is just an old saying, which I read from one of my favorite writers, Jim Harrison. You know Jim Harrison's work?
Yeah, I actually have corresponded with Jim, and I consider Dalva to be one of the finest novels that I've read in a long time.
I agree. I completely agree.
I would buy Jim's books just for Russell Chatham's dust covers.
I think he's one of our finest writers, too.
Yeah.
I believe Dalva is the epigraph to Dalva, Jim Harrison's novel, and this is the line. We loved the earth, but could not stay. And I found that to be the first line coming out of my mouth at the church during his funeral mass, because Dad loved the earth, loved everything about it. He was a very sensual, hedonistic man. It's all through his work. But he was also a tortured Catholic.
Yes, yes.
No, and I don't mean that lightly. I mean tortured in that he wrestled with what it is to live a spiritual life. How does one do it?
Yes.
And how do we ever achieve it?
One of the things that he wrote, and this was something in, I believe it was in one of his essays, Andre, was he talked about the sacrament of making breakfast for your children and of pouring coffee for your wife, and that these were the sacraments that we do each day, and that the discipline of doing these sacraments was an essential part of life. And I know he was a daily communicant, and he believed in the Eucharist. And he was a man who would not stick a fish on his car, but would help anyone. In fact, he did help people at times, breaking up fights. And he just he was like a good Samaritan, in the sense that he didn't care what a person did or where they came from. If they were being injured or someone was doing them wrong, he would intercede.
Yeah, he absolutely would. That was his nature. He would go to it without thinking about it. That's how he got crippled, you know, rushing Davidson with the highway, and he got run over. I was going to say something about the spiritual life, and I lost my train of thought with his... There was an image coming to me about the old man. But it'll come back.
Okay, yeah, we can edit, you know, what edit is. That's no problem. We'll do a short break here. Hold on 1 second. You're listening to the Casey Kowar Show. We're going to take a short break. Our guest today is Andre Dubuse III, and we'll be right back to talk more about his father's work. Welcome back to the Casey Kowar Show. Our guest today is Andre Dubuse III, and we're discussing the work of his father, Andre Dubuse. And Andre, I know that that when the film In the Bedroom came out, that it took a lot of people by surprise when they discovered that this was a short story that your father wrote in 1980, and that a story that was, I believe, is it 18 pages?
I think so.
I think it's 18 pages. That in 18 pages, Todd Fields was able to turn that into a screenplay and a movie, which just resonated with, I think, the original beauty of your father's story.
I think Dad would have loved that film. He read the screenplay before he died.
Oh, did he really?
He did. So he got to see exactly what Todd had done. You know, in the story, for those who don't know the story, I won't give too much away, but it's about a man and woman who loses their son to a shooting and have to live in the same little town where his murderer is walking free. And Dad actually got this idea from a story of it's really happened in our little town of Haverhill where I grew up. A guy got off, and again, this is the writer's imagination, that what if? Well, what if you kept seeing the guy who killed one of your kids?
Yeah.
What would you do? And Field did a beautiful job, though. Excuse me. In the story, I believe the father's a grocer and the mother's a housewife, right?
Yeah, and they have other kids in the story too. There are two
other
children.
They have an older son, and in the Todd Field version, the dad's a doctor, the mother's a music professor. They live in Maine, and it's not the Merrimack Valley, Massachusetts. But again, it's interesting, this whole act of adaptation. Well, what is loyal? Is it a literal transcription of the story? Not necessarily.
No.
I think a good adaptation or a loyal adaptation is just true to the heart of the thing.
Yeah.
And true to the people in it. And the old man loved Field's adaptation.
I'm glad to hear that, because that doesn't surprise me. Because, I mean, really, if you have 18 pages, the odds of developing a screenplay that were as good as that one was really are pretty slim. So,
and by the way, I just saw an image, a photograph at my sister's house last week that I hadn't seen before. She's got on her wall that Todd Field had sent her, and it's a picture of Sissy Spacek and Tom Wilkinson, the two leads in the bedroom of the film, sitting in their hotel room in Maine, each with a copy of the selected stories in my dad's mug right there.
Oh, my Lord.
If they would keep referring to the original story to help them perform in the film.
Wow. That's that's a testimony to not only your father, but to Sissy Spacek and Tom Wilkinson.
Yeah, you know, when I met Sissy Spacek at one of the premieres, I said, you know, my old man had such a crush on you. It would kill him not to. I said, if he were alive here, he would have you on his lap in his wheelchair in about 90 seconds.
She wouldn't have had a chance, would she?
No, she wouldn't.
No.
Not at all.
No, she probably knew it. I got to admit that I was walking through the bookstore one day, and I saw the Vintage Contemporaries edition titled In the Bedroom.
Yeah.
And my heart sunk at first, and I thought, oh no, you know, not, you know. And then I picked
it's not his title.
No, it's not his title. And
right.
I thought, if they did a like a novelization of the movie or something, or published something that, you know, that he did not want published, I would have been sick. But then I saw the foreword by Todd Field, and I saw that it was seven stories that he wrote, and so I breathed a sigh of relief, because I thought, oh, they can't, you know, start messing with this stuff now that he can't defend it. And but I knew you were one of the literary co-executors. So
let me assure you out loud that my sister and I, ain't no way anybody is getting close to the old man's work ever that he would not want out there.
Good.
You know, I actually think it's just such a disgrace when a dead writer's work gets pillaged, gone through, and published. That is so wrong. It's a rape of the man or woman's work. It's terrible to do that.
It's disgusting.
No, but you know, I want to tell you too, he has real friends in his publisher, Random House Vintage. I mean, they loved him as a man. They love his work. And while, yes, they're a publishing house and they're in the business of making money, etc., there are some really good people there who really love the thought of seizing any